Poetry on the radio, poetry in and around the ACT. Today, we speak with celebrated American poet Tony Barnstone, plus the Rhyming Bugle. For Art Sound FM, I'm Kimberly K. Williams. Tony Barnstone is the prolific creator of varied output, who has won many awards and honors. He's published more than 20 books of poetry, and he is also a literary translator and essayist. His Tongue of War, From Pearl Harbor to Nagasaki, is a book of dramatic monologues set in the Pacific during the Second World War, based on interviewing many military vets. It was the basis for a CD of songs entitled Tokyo Burning, World War II Songs. You'll hear some of that during these two episodes of Poetry on the Radio. For another of his books of verse, Pulp Sonnets, Tony Barnstone drew on 20 years of research into classic pulp fiction, gothic literature, B-movies, and comic books. With illustrations by Iranian artist Amin Mansouri, it is a sort of graphic novel in verse. Barnstone has also published books of translations of Chinese poems, including erotic poems, and of ghazals by Ghalib, the acclaimed 19th century romantic and mystical poet of the Mughal Empire, written in Urdu, the dominant language of northern India and Pakistan. He has also published a set of richly illustrated tarot cards, the Radiant Tarot, designed to spark creativity. Tony Barnstone comes from a family of poets, as we'll hear. He earned a PhD at the University of California at Berkeley under poets Robert Pinsky and Robert Haas, and is now a professor of English at Whittier College in California. We interviewed him when he and his Sydney-based brother, Robert Barnstone, an architect, were in Canberra in November for the annual conference of the Australasian Association of Writing Programs. Let's begin by hearing him read a sonnet about lost love, and then a narrative poem, a short story in verse, from a forthcoming volume based on memories of an Indiana childhood.
This is a sonnet. It's from a book of sonnets, a kind of a novel in verse called Sad Jazz. And it's about a couple who fall in love. They get married, they get trouble into the marriage, they get divorced, they separate, and they go through the stages of recovery. And so it kind of follows them sonnet by sonnet. This is called Moving Day. It's late in the book. He piles her boxes in the courtyard under a tarp, the bookshelves, microwave, spare phone. And though his friends make clear, they wonder why he would help her move, he says, it's fine. I want to save her money, help her out. And he does, helps her move out, feeling weight tear at his muscles. Now he is without her things. They are inside the truck, her freight, then on the freeway, then in her new flat, then gone. He's glad to ache in shoulder blades and arms. It means that though she's left him flat, left him behind like old footprints, he's made a choice as well to move her, remove her, a choice to move past, not be moved by her. This is Rec Room, and spelled W-R-E-C-K. Rec Room in America is recreation room, right? Andrea's tenuous body is a hanger for bell-bottom jeans and a plaid shirt with one tail dangling. She doesn't tuck in the loose tail or comb her long, lank hair. Her head is filled with hippie ideals learned from pop songs that assure her she is stardust, that she should let her freak flag fly, that all she needs is love, and that she should love the one she's with. But she's so shy that her leg is always skidding around under the table, and her voice cracks and stutters when speaking to boys and teachers. So when Duke and Rick ask her to come over after school, she says sure, even though it was Duke who shoved her back one recess so that she stepped right through her cello's golden belly, where she'd laid it on the grass like an angel in a body bag. Duke lives in a flaked and buckled brown row house 3 blocks from school. They trek through the lion grass of the neighbor's lawn and slide open the glass door below the balcony in the back into what Duke calls the rec room. Concrete floor, torn red bench press and set of iron weights, chipped green ping pong table, dartboard with black feathered darts, hunting rifle on a wooden rack on the far wall, patched leather couch facing a small boxy color TV propped up on a wood moving crate. Duke cracks the mini fridge in the corner and pulls out a can of Schlitz. He punches Andrea in the arm, peacocking a bit and grinning happily. My dad says, beer is God's apology for creating cancer. But when Rick bends over to get himself one, Duke's smile tightens. He grabs Rick by the belt at the back of his jeans and lifts him in the air, arms and legs and ratty blonde hair dangling like a heavy metal spider. Fuck you! Fuck you! Fuck you! Ha 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 ha! Duke shoves a hand into the crack between the cushions and pulls out something from within, like a doctor pulling out a baby's head. He slips it into the VCR, and the television crackles to life, moaning and sighing. Duke plops on the couch, kicks feet up on a stool, and winks at Andrea, who stands shyly against a wall, peeking at the blue screen where bodies are coiling around each other like the supple, strange tentacles of a giant octopus. But Rick looks bored. He sits on the red bench and bends into a few curls. He tosses a dart and misses, hitting the pockmarked millwork paneling. He lifts the rifle off the rack, slips a finger around the trigger, and aims it at Andrea's head. Andrea is saying, "Hey, hey!" But Rick is laughing. Andrea walks left, right. She lopes through the door into the hallway, past two bedrooms dark as burial chambers, and back into the rec room again. But Rick runs after, keeping the rifle pointed at her head, all the parts of it, action, trigger, butt and hammer, lock, stock and barrel, the black mouth of the muzzle whispering, "Death." The television groans in pleasure. Duke is smiling with a hand inside his jeans. Rick is laughing grimly as Andrea runs through the house, the chalky skin of the drywall, fogged low windows like congealed white eyes, veins and arteries of the hallways, the panting heart of the television, the beast fur carpeting, and a voice somewhere screaming, "Oh!" So you see I'm trying to do a little short stories and poetry there.
My colleague, Peter Monahan, asked Tony Barnstone about his approach to form and his conception of poetry as speech acts.
I saw your approach described, that maybe you said this yourself, as formal poetry with a free verse aesthetic.
Yes. That's definitely true. I mean, I started out as a free verse poet and didn't actually enjoy formal poetry as much when I was younger. And so when I started writing formal poetry, it really started because I was translating the sonnets of Jorge Luis Borges, and I figured if I'm going to translate the sonnets, I'll translate them as sonnets. And after I'd done a number of them, I found myself writing my own sonnets. The form was in my head. But I still had the free verse aesthetic, so I think that unlike a lot of sonneteers, I was less locked into the idea that every stanza is a box for meaning, every line is a kind of end stop thing. I was much more interested in the river flow than the kind of dammed up form as modular Legos.
The way that you've adapted form, it's a way of capturing a certain kind of energy, poetic energy, but it's more than that. It's like a rigorous sort of muscular mode of thought.
That's nicely put. My first book of poems was called Impure. And I have an article out called Impure Poetry that you can find online. And the idea there is that I'm not interested in, you know, polite poetry about coffee and flowers. I'm interested in poetry that is transgressive, that makes something happen. W.H. Auden said in his elegy to William Butler Yeats, poetry makes nothing happen. But Wittgenstein, Searle, Judith Butler, other philosophers and theorists talk about language that makes stuff happen. Performative speech. Like if I say to you, "I hereby sentence you to be hung by the neck until you shall be dead," that's performative, right? So I want poetry to do that, act on the person emotionally in such a way that it makes something spark in the brain, some kind of epiphany that's not just beautiful, but also has a kind of sociological or psychological oomph.
That touches on another aspect of your poetry, is that you don't shirk from difficulty. But actually, I do find your poetry relatively accessible despite that. You must work very hard on conveying what you're talking about even though the concepts aren't necessarily very straightforward.
Yeah, there's an ancient Chinese poetry talk about poetry, and says it's the most difficult thing is to write a simple line. Right. And when I was a grad student and I was studying with Bob Haas over at Berkeley, I was his first graduate student, I'm proud to say. And the National Poetry Slam came to San Francisco. So I went off to one of the bars where they were performing, and I got up there with all these National Poetry Slam champions. And in the on the fly, I had to revise all the poems I was submitting to Haas's workshop and take out all the $64 words, because it wasn't going to fly with this drunk crowd of, you know, of neo-beat slam poets. And that was my original lesson. You know, don't put in the bullshit. You know, be straight. And you can make it difficult. You can make it nuanced. You can make interesting things happen without necessarily making it poetry with a capital P.
Is there a typical way then that you will work on a poem? They seem burnished.
Well, that's nicely put. I do burnish them. I have a lot of different techniques. One technique may seem very mechanical, but I will go through a selection of poems I'm about to publish, and I will highlight it in three different colors for nouns, verbs, and adjectives, the power words. And then I'll challenge every noun, verb, and adjective and determine, A, is it the right one? B, is it interesting? C, is it doing something exciting? And change every one that's not. So that's one thing I'll do. And another thing I'll do is I'm interested in, on the one hand, making it accessible, making it a flow, making it have a free verse aesthetic, even if it's a formal poem. But I also want it to have a musical quality. So sometimes I use a semi-surreal technique where I'll take a keyword from a line, let's say it's the word dust, and I'll just create a palette, like a painter's palette, of words that sound like dust. And they could be, you know, rust or bust or must, or it could be durst or don't, right? Or they could be various kinds of slant rhymes or full consonants. And then essentially use that as the color palette to figure out if I can weave some of those words somewhere in to sub in for other words. So it creates these internal resonances. And so what ends up happening is that it becomes more burnished. It becomes more acrobatic. But the first time you write it, it can be more energetic. It's like you're throwing a football for the long bomb, not for the short pass. And you're doing the long arc, and then it kind of begins to descend. And once you have that long arc and you figure out what your tropes are and what the shape of the poem is, then you can begin to make sure it's exciting every line of the way in the football pass, to kind of push a metaphor too far.
As you talk, I can recognize that your attraction is to the more complicated of American poetry and other as well, obviously. How do things that are currently very much a part of poetry, like identity, fit in with your conception of what's happening in poetry? Are there trends that you find less useful than others, perhaps?
Many decades of teaching students with very different aesthetics have opened me up to pretty much any poetic mode. And my only real concern is, does the poem work well based on the rubrics or the kind of standards or the expectations that it itself sets up? And I don't care what rules it's breaking. I don't care what, you know, identities it's taking on. I don't care what politics it has. I don't care what form or lack of form it has. I don't care if it's musical or experimental or free verse or what. I just care if it works within its own terms. And so for me, the bottom line is quality as I see it. And of course, everybody else will see it in different ways. But long ago, when I gave up being a professional artist and decided just to paint for fun, I decided I can go into museums, and if I look at a Picasso and I don't like it, I can say, that's shit. It doesn't matter that it's Picasso, right? And I kind of feel the same way about poetry as well. I can say that shit, and it doesn't matter, because maybe my shit is, you know, your gold, and that's the whole point. It's not that the poem is a lock that if you have the right key, you can open up. It's that your brain is a lock, and every poem will open up every person in a different way, because we all have different locks. The poem is the key. For some of us, it's not, you know, some poems won't fit my lock at all, but they're going to fit yours. So that's my, maybe I'm ducking the question, but I try to be open to anybody who's a serious artist, and I hope that they achieve what they're trying to achieve.
The follow-up to that then, I guess, is Do you find, particularly given the sort of demography or the variety of students that you've encountered over the years, that there are modes of poetry that you find, well, obviously surprising, but you also find sort of refreshing and then enlightening? And they may be ways of saying things that aren't readily identified even as poetry, perhaps.
I've had some pretty remarkable students. I am always kind of surprised, again, I'm not exactly answering your question, but I'm always surprised that the ones who have the most talent in college are often not the ones who go on to publish books or go on to graduate school or become professors or whatever the case may be. I think because it comes too easily to them. But it's the ones who are immensely ambitious and stubborn as hell. And they may not have had their voice in college, but they're going to stick to it because they loved it and it did something to them. And they're going to keep working on it till they get it. And so often, you know, sometimes I'm kind of shocked and surprised by what my students do. But often those are not the ones who will end up becoming professional poets. They might very well become extraordinary lawyers and doctors or something else because they're brilliant. So I would say that I've been pushed a little more by grad students than by undergraduates, because often undergraduates come to my class without a significant poetic background. My class may be the first time where they wrote significantly, intensely over a period of time. Maybe they wrote a little bit in their journals in high school and so on. Remember, I'm teaching only undergraduates at Whittier, and occasionally I'm teaching grad students as a visiting professor. The short answer is I find more inspiration by reading international literature than for my students, because I find that international literature will be writing in truly different modes than I'm used to. And translation keeps your tools sharp, says Kenneth Rexroth.
One of Tony Barnstone's fascinating projects is the Radiant Tarot, a set of tarot cards designed to spark poetic and other creative impulses. Barnstone imbues the cards with insights from a vast array of poets and other thinkers, as well as his own writing, and worked with artist Alexandra Eldridge to produce richly illustrated visual, verbal, and symbolic card texts.
It seems to me that you tend to work on big projects.
Yeah.
The Radiant Tarot took 12 years, mm-hmm. Is that right? I could see how somebody might find this book and maybe not even see the poetry in it, though I see it everywhere.
Sure. So the Radiant Tarot Pathway to Creativity is a project I did with the artist, the Santa Fe, New Mexico artist, Alexandra Eldridge. Alexandra and I both have a great love of William Blake. I was going to do my PhD thesis on him. I ended up switching to William Cross Williams. But my son's name is Blake William Barnstone. They would put a little pressure on him, but they didn't call him William Blake Barnstone. It's Blake William Barnstone. And one of her sons' name is Blake. In fact, she married her college art professor, who was a Blake scholar, and together they created Golgonusa, which was a hippie commune in Ohio, near where he taught, and on his family farm, where they built crazy buildings that looked like they came out of Dr. Seuss or something. And they put on plays and made tapestries and did art and put on performances and lived according to the spiritual principles of Blake's work. And it all was really wonderful and great until the neighbors, who were fundamentalist Christians, assumed that they were devil worshipers and burned the place down. So anyways, that's America. So one long story short, we saw eye to eye right off the bat, and we ended up working for 12 years on this thing, which evolved into, it really is a regular tarot deck with all the cards and with the interpretations. You can do readings of people and all the rest, but it's been adapted to the neuroscience of creativity, the history, philosophy, and neuroscience of creativity. Mm-hmm. Couple insights we got along the way. One, you know how in the typical deck of cards you have the four suits, you know, hearts, clubs, spades, diamonds. Well, those come from the tarot suits. They evolved out of the traditional tarocchi cards that came out of the Italian Renaissance. The hearts are the cups, and the spades are the swords, and the clubs are the staffs or the wands, right? And the diamonds are the pentacles, right? But they also have meanings. There's certain meanings to the cards that are there, but there are particular meanings in the tarot deck that align with the how psychologists and psychiatrists understand the creative process. So, you know, the meditative, the incubation process where you're still just getting the ideas and it's there in the unconscious and you're kind of sleeping on it and waiting for it to emerge, that's the cups, right? The emotional, the watery. The moment of inspiration, that kind of breakthrough, the eureka moment, that's the fiery wands, right? The moment of revision where you're applying the reason and you're cutting and arranging and all the rest, that's the swords. Right, that's the rational mind of the swords, and the moment of manifestation and putting it out into the world and grounding it and rooting it, that's the pentacles. So those four elements are the four elements of the tarot, but also of creativity. So we pushed that further and adapted every suit and every card to the creative process, so that in the book I wrote to explain how to use the deck, every card is associated with a creative act. A creative process that you can put into your life itself. It doesn't necessarily mean writing a poem or doing a dance or making a painting, although some of them involve those things. It might be as simple as playing creative games together with friends in your living room while you're all drunk on a Saturday night. It might mean taking a long walk with an idea in your head and walking until a certain spot where you sit down and you see how that idea evolved as the world walked through and the endorphins went off in your brain. So there are ways of kind of using creativity to expand your familial and social roots while at the same time connecting you to community and helping you to reimagine your life. That's the kind of quick summary.
So each of the cards has a page,
yeah.
And the beginning of each page of each card, there are a couple lines of poetry.
Yes.
Where do those come from?
Part of the creative process is that you, unlike, let's say, a mathematical process, where if you make a mistake somewhere along the way, the final answer is wrong. In the creative process, you often have to take missteps to get to the right ending, right? So my original idea for this was I was going to write a deck of cards that was a book of poems, so that each card would be a double sonnet, upright and reversed, like the tarot card can be upright and reversed, but it would be published as a deck of cards so they had no order. You could shuffle it and see what came out. So most of these little two-line snippets come from those sonnets I wrote originally. But it's unclear who said this, Hemingway, Faulkner, somebody else, but writers need to kill their darlings,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And the sonnets were my darlings. And I had to kill them because the project wanted to go somewhere else.
Yes. You do a lot with sonnets.
Yes.
And I wondered if you would read one,
yeah.
And if you would talk about why this form works for you.
A couple of things about this. This is called Lamp or Mirror. And it was one of the sonnets I wrote inspired by Jorge Luis Borges, who has some really exciting, interesting ideas about the philosophy of the phenomenology of the mind and of perception in his poetry. And Lamp or Mirror is kind of a classic study of Western literature that is rooted on the question of whether the mind is a mirror to the world or the mind is a lamp projecting on the world. So if we're a mirror to the world, then, you know, coming from a rationalist perspective, whatever's inside should represent whatever's outside, and that's sanity, right? For Blake, that's the reality. So, like, for Freud, that's the reality principle. But if you're a lamp, that means whatever's on the inside is being projected out onto the world, so that your mind, your eyes are almost like movie projectors,
yeah.
Playing your meanings across nature. Right, so do you read the book of nature and find God in it, as you know Milton says you can do, or do you project your idea of God onto nature when a nature, in fact, is just red in tooth and claw? So that this is called Lamp or Mirror, and it's a bit about that question of whether your dreams are real, whether the mind is a dream, whether the world is a dream, and what happens if we wake. When strange light stirs the mirror, forces swirl the shadows by the bathtub, and I glimpse a figure standing, glowing. As I rinse the toothpaste down the drain, his blind eye whirls numinous white. His hair is moonlight streaming. I know neurologists have shown the course of dreaming as synaptic lines of force. And even in this dream, I know I'm dreaming. Yet When the light refracts at such an angle, it shows his broken face, frost in his beard, his black lips mouthing words I only hear as moaning of an operatic angel. His ice hand reaches out. I flinch in fear. The mirror breaks. I gasp awake. He's here.
Lately, Tony Barnstone says, many of his poems have featured a narrative approach. We heard one of those near the beginning of this program, and now here's another. Both are from a forthcoming volume, The Rec Room, where he revisits memoirs from his childhood in Indiana. This time, he imagines vengeance on a bully with fingers chopped off at the knuckles.
I had a particularly bad childhood bully. Bad hand. The yellow mouth of the school bus opened to eat him, and he slumped into the fractured plastic of his seat, knowing at the next stop, the boy with the fingers chopped off at the knuckles would climb into the bus like a panther among squirrels, take the seat behind him, and grind the whitened stumps into the back of his head while he flinched. What combination of starry omens and planetary dread, of boxcars and snake eyes, could have spun the world inside this child's heart to such daily vicious thrill at the despair of other children, the one with perfect hands. At lunch, huddled with friends by the mahogany-stained fold-up bleachers in the gym, he tried to ask them, but they studied dented apples and plastic rat sandwiches in wincing silence. In their minds, the awful hand was reaching over the ruptured and taped upholstery again and scraping like a bone bow across their resisting bodies, grating out the thin music of their screams, these beautiful little boys and girls who flinched away from the stumps of his loss. They also had suffered the knuckle torture, also had avoided the bus home, preferring to stumble through the cut black stubble of the cornfields and be late for dinner, but they could say nothing. He was a fact of life, like brain-eating bacteria. So the boy came up with his own scenarios for what violence had severed that hand. A bad cut on his table saw that spritzed the sawdust red. Freak guillotining by falling glass. Psycho stepfather with a hatchet. And often he wondered, what did they do with the severed digits? Did they keep them? Strangely preserved in formaldehyde, floating and pointing everywhere and nowhere in the green liquid of a screw-top jar? Or did they bury them in a small box out in a field somewhere, or in the backyard by the oak tree, like a time capsule floating in earth through decades in which that sad and terrible boy was fated to be the asshole of every story? A tiny coffin in a makeshift graveyard where those fingers wait for the rest of him to join them, those pallid fetuses, those curling orchids, those question marks, the pale nails growing into hooks.
Today, our guest on Poetry on the Radio has been Tony Barnstone. He will be next week, too, along with his brother, architect Robert Barnstone. I'm Kimberly K. Williams.
The Rhyming Bugle. At Smith's Alternative in Civic, on December 18, That Poetry Thing says goodbye to 2023 by taking a look back on another year of poetry before breaking until January 22. If you've ever aspired to create radio programs like this one, or podcasts for that matter, then you may be interested in the course that ArtSound FM is offering in collaboration with the University of Canberra's Short Course Program. It's entitled Podcasting 101, and it will take place on Saturday, the 20th of January, and Saturday, the 27th of January in the afternoons, a two-day course. It'll take place at the ArtSound Studios at the Manuka Arts Centre. If you're interested, you can go online to the University of Canberra website and look for Podcasting 101 with ArtSound FM. Poetry on the Radio is produced weekly on unceded traditional land in the studios of ArtSound FM and airs Sundays at 4:30 p.m. and again at 10:30 p.m. on Mondays and online at artsound.fm. Series hosts are Kimberly K. Williams and Peter Searles, who produced the program with me, Peter Monahan. Our theme is an imagining of an ancient Greek hymn to the muse Calliope by Gregoria Paniagua and the Atrium Musica de Madrid.
Art Sound FM, your music and arts companion.